Welcome to the Daily Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. You can subscribe to us. I say this every time, but I need to remind some of you. You can subscribe to us on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher. And if you do leave a comment, if you assuming that you like the podcast, if you leave a positive comment, believe it or not, that actually makes a difference. So I think it's time to do a somewhat deeper dive on the president's emergency orders and all of the powers that have been invested in the president. And who better to do that than our longtime friend Adam White, who joins me. Adam, thanks for joining me on the podcast today.
Great to be here, Charlie.
Well, let's just talk about this because this is there's so many different levels of the speculation that the president might declare a national emergency in order to build the wall without congressional approval. I don't want to start with one point that the founders when they delineated the powers of the president did not provide provisions for the president of the United States to issue emergency orders. In fact, all of those authorities are the result of congressional grants, correct?
Well, largely correct. There is an open question that's been debated since the beginning of our country over war powers, whether the president has the power in the case of an emergency of an attack or an invasion to summon up the military and respond even absent a congressional declaration of war. So there is that emergency power that's definitely there. And from the beginning, the courts and Congress have, you know, vested power in the president, or the courts have created space for the president to act in response to new circumstances and so on. But you're right. What we're talking about in the context of this wall or slats or whatever it is a debate over whether statutes that Congress passed over the years give the president the power to build this wall without further authorization and appropriations from Congress.
You know, I was reading up on this, and what struck me is that this question of how much power does the president have to make these decisions unilaterally, this has come up before. In fact, in the early 1970s, there was this growing realization that, wow, maybe Congress had given the president too many emergency powers. And by 1973, Congress had enacted more than 470 statutes granting the president special authorities upon the declaration of a national emergency. And that's really why they passed the National Emergencies Act in 1976, because the point of that, in fact, was to somehow pare back that authority, right? To sort of like, this has gotten out of hand. We need to put some walls around this. We need to use that, or some fences around the president's powers.
Right. And also some procedures and some formalities to channel that kind of presidential power, to make sure the president goes through some sort of regularized, formalized steps before doing anything. And that move by Congress in the 70s was part of a wave of statutes that happened throughout the 70s that were intended, rightly or wrongly, to rein in the president. The War Powers Act, the surveillance statutes, even the campaign finance laws that arose in the 1970s, they were all part of that reassertion of power by Congress against the president in the aftermath of Nixon and also in the aftermath of Vietnam.
Yeah, but sort of yes and no, because the law says that each House of Congress has to meet every 6 months to consider whether to terminate a national emergency by joint resolution. But Congress has never done that. It has never met to consider such a vote.
Right.
So, yes, they did write in statute certain restraints, but then Congress apparently has done what Congress has done over the last several decades, which was to not exercise that power. And therefore, as a result, this presidential power seems to, you know, continue to grow.
That's right. So often we talk about the imperial presidency or the administrative state in terms of the president or agencies reaching out and claiming powers that aren't theirs. But that's only part of the story. So much of the story is Congress either deliberately or casually handing the president or handing agencies extremely broad powers that they later come to regret. I saw this firsthand in a very interesting way in the very first weeks of the Trump administration. I was called to testify before a Senate committee on kind of a mundane regulatory issue about cost-benefit analysis and the delegation of power to agencies. And this hearing came right on the heels of President Trump's initial travel ban. And so you had a bunch of Democratic senators complaining about the travel ban and really pushing a lot of the other witnesses at the hearings who represented the Chamber of Commerce and other big industrial groups to criticize the travel ban. And I just kind of sat there quietly chuckling to myself because I thought Congress is complaining about broad statutes that by and large gave the president the power to do what he was trying to do, as the Supreme Court later affirmed. And so Congress really should look in the mirror if it wants to complain about this. And then the great irony, of course, was that hearing, as soon as the Democratic senators were done complaining about the travel ban, they went back to criticizing those who had urged Congress to put more checks on the rest of the administration.
So we have about, what, 30 or so national emergencies declared pursuant to that law right now?
Yeah, I can't remember the current number, and most of them are pretty much, you know, in the big scheme of things, are pretty mundane. They've become, instead of the exception, they've become the new normal. You just reaffirm these emergency declarations over and over again so that the powers that are used by the president or these agencies can continue without interruption.
You know, when I said that this has so many different layers, you know, obviously the one that concerns me the most would be the precedent that it would set, that if in fact the president invokes this sort of power, it doesn't take much imagination. We've written about this to imagine what a President Bernie Sanders or a President Elizabeth Warren might do. But you want to nerd out a little bit on Section 2808, which is the Emergency Military Construction Authority, whether or not that provides the president the power to build this wall without congressional action?
Well, that's one of a couple of statutes that allow the president to redirect spending that's been authorized elsewhere for military purposes. The idea being that while Congress may have appropriated money for specific reasons, the president, as commander in chief of the military, needs to have some sort of discretion to redirect funds as necessary for the prerogatives of the military.
You know, there's a lot of complexity here, including the fact that if this is ever litigated, it would be what I understand is the technical term, the question of first impression, that we really just simply do not know how far the president can take this particular declaration the statute basically says, you know, that upon the declaration of a national emergency that requires the use of the armed forces, that the Secretary of Defense may, quote, without regard to any other provision of the law, undertake military construction projects not otherwise authorized by law that are necessary to support such use of armed forces.
Right.
So that's got a lot of, well, what does that mean? How would you apply that? Does a wall... Is a wall necessary to support the use of the armed forces? A lot of other questions.
Right, and I didn't want to... other statute I had in mind is 33 U.S.C. 2293, which I'll get to in a second. I just wanted to keep them straight. Mm-hmm. 10, as you said, 10 U.S.C. 2808 allows the president, in the case of a national emergency that's declared under the Emergencies Act, that he can undertake military construction projects that are necessary to support the use of the armed forces. And that's the key, right, is that this is not a provision to give the president power to take money away from the armed forces for other projects. It's just for infrastructure necessary to support the use of the armed forces. The classic example would be something like a bridge or a road or other things like that. Here, it's true that there's military involved with the border, if only because the president is summoning them down or trying to summon them down in large numbers. To block the caravan and other things that he's been complaining about. But it's very hard to say with a straight face that the wall is necessary to support the use of the armed forces. If anything, it's the other direction. The president wants to use the armed forces ultimately to support the wall. And so what it requires is the president, making a finding that this wall is necessary to support the use of the armed forces. And then in turn, it requires the courts to defer to that judgment. And I just want to say the other statute at issue 33-2293, it says that the president may use, he may reprogram funds for civil works, that are essential to national defense, but that only applies to previously authorized projects. And so, again, it requires the president to make a declaration of emergency and apply and reprogram these resources for this new military use. And once again, it all comes back to, first of all, whether the program is essential, and second of all, whether we're genuinely in an emergency.
Exactly. I mean, that's the, he has to actually, under the law, you know, make a factual determination, right, to say right. that there's a factual basis to invoke that particular section. And given the fact that he tweeted out over the last several days that everything's been solved on the border and that he's already handled it, you could certainly imagine rather vigorous litigation over that question before we get into all the other questions.
That's right. Even if the president had never tweeted those things, never made those statements, there'd still be an open question over whether the facts genuinely support the president's findings. And to be clear, almost certainly, if the president goes forward with this emergency declaration, the Justice Department, the White House Counsel's Office, and others will ensure that the official document the president signs, whether it's an executive order or other kind of declaration, is it checks all the necessary boxes. It covers and says all the sort of magic words you need to trigger, as a formal matter, the use of these powers. But the question would still be whether the courts should look under the hood, right, or look behind the curtain, however you want to put it, and decide for itself whether the facts on the ground justify what the president's doing. Normally, courts defer largely to president's yes. judgments on these mm-hmm. things. And I think the White House and Justice Department are probably taking for granted or almost for granted that that deference would apply here. And I'm sure in court they would argue and demand that the same deference to the president's judgments apply here. But the fact is, those laws were written by and large for conventional presidents, and they were administered by conventional presidents. And the question, even setting aside President Trump's tweets, is how the courts should grapple with these legal questions when you have a president who goes out of his way to sort of show off the fact that he is an unconventional, even anti-conventional president.
So that raises the question whether or not the judges in this case, or the justices, would make their ruling based on this president, as opposed to a veil of not knowing who it was. You could certainly imagine lower courts doing that because there is really no precedent. Well, that's not true. When the courts rejected Harry Truman's takeover of U.S. Steel, how did that play out? If you remember that case.
Well, that's a famous case
That was a really drawing a hard line. The president cannot invoke emergency powers to just seize an industry.
Right. The formal name of that case is Youngstown Sheet and Tube Company versus Sawyer. But the case is so important and so famous, it has its own sort of alternative name, the Steel Seizures case. It was so famous. There, the court struck down what the Truman administration and the Commerce Department was trying to do, namely the takeover of the domestic steel industry in order to support the Korean War effort. The court struck that down because they held there was no statute that authorized what the president was trying to do, and this was not an area where the president could act in the absence of a statute. What we're talking about here is slightly more complicated because here we do have statutes, the statutes we were just talking about, which the president and Justice Department will invoke, saying here we have direct congressional authorization for what the president is trying to do. So the court has to go one step further and decide whether the statute really applies to the facts at hand. And with this case, the question, or I'd say the closest analogy in recent memory is actually the Supreme Court's affirmance of the Trump administration's eventual version of the travel ban. This mm-hmm. is the Hawaii case. Mm-hmm. There, the court upheld what the president did, said it was justified under the statutes. It did not violate the First Amendment or other constitutional prohibitions against discrimination. It was a very difficult case because of what the president had said on the campaign trail, especially where he had issued statements, you know, so often on Twitter, but also elsewhere, you know, really denigrating Muslims, really saying pretty horrible things. The Justice Department distanced the ultimate decision by the president from those prior statements. The court had to grapple with how much weight to give those old statements that were contrary to the purported justification of the eventual travel ban by the Justice Department. That is a close case. I think if the administration or the administration's supporters, or even the administration's critics, want to assume that that's how the Supreme Court is going to approach every case, I just think they're mistaken. I think that case was a close case. I think the court ultimately was right that you can't take every sort of campaign statement and write it in stone and use it as a basis for rejecting every subsequent act as president. But here, where you have the president saying so many things in office, and making clear that sometimes there's an emergency, sometimes he doesn't think there's an emergency, making clear that he's using the emergency power really as a negotiating tactic, if nothing else, I think it's going to be harder for the Supreme Court to just turn away from that and restrain its judicial review to the four corners of whatever presidential decision document is ultimately issued by the White House.
What about the Posse Comitatus Act, the limitations on the use of the U.S. military? Does that come into play at all in the question of the declaration of a military emergency on the border?
Well, I don't know how the interplay with the emergency statutes would be for Posse Comitatus. I'll say this is a better argument for the administration that Posse Comitatus does not prevent them from using the military at the border. This is not a strictly domestic police situation. He is, you know, sending troops down to the border to prevent people from coming in from outside of the country. You know, there, I think it's not as clear to me that Posse Comitatus actually bars the use of the military for border defense. In fact, I suspect otherwise.
I want to shift gears a little bit more on the political side of all of this, the be careful what you wish for side. There's a piece in Politico. I don't know whether you've seen it. I'll share it with you. It's everything stays on the table. All the 2020 Democrats are weighing killing the filibuster. And of course, this has been something that Republicans have been, you know, wrestling with is, do we nuke the filibuster in order to get our legislation through? And President Trump has been, over a period of time, been lashing Mitch McConnell to abolish the filibuster so that we don't need 60 votes. But now there's this moment where the Democrats are saying maybe we would do it if we wanted to implement, you know, for example, Medicare for All or our environmental legislation. It is one of those moments, I'm hoping, that conservatives would take a step back and go, you know, changing the rules in order to get and the constitutional balance in order to get a short-term win can have long-term negative consequences. And it's kind of amazing that they need to relearn that lesson.
Yeah, and I'll say this version of the argument is a nice reminder of the fact that the Trump administration and President Trump's approach has a lot in common with his predecessor, President Obama. And the arguments you're seeing now from Democrats saying, well, if you do this with emergency powers, here's what we could do. It sounds exactly like the arguments you saw towards the end of the Obama administration, where President Obama was using non-enforcement of immigration laws, marijuana laws, and so on to advance policy. And you had Republicans say, well, look what we could do. Look what we could do, perhaps, in terms of waiving or not enforcing tax laws or other areas of the law. It's the exact same shoes on the other foot kind of argument we saw during the Obama years. I just brought up on my computer, in addition to the Politico article, an article I get, since I focus on regulation, one of the trade publications I get is called Energy and Environment News. They have a publication called Climate Wire, and their lead article today is called "This is what a climate emergency declaration looks like." And here you have these reporters walking through the ways in which a future administration might use the emergency statutes to justify radical action on climate change. And it's not clear to me whether these arguments are tactical, right? Whether they're just trying to scare Republicans away from using emergency powers here, or whether they're genuine. But I think we should take them seriously. I think this is the general trajectory of our policy, which is ever more executive power in lieu of congressional action, and members of Congress themselves welcoming this rather than actually legislating on these important issues, just leaving these things to the president to decide through this this stockpile of emergency statutes that lie around like loaded weapons just waiting to be used.
You know, that is a great point. And what we're seeing is that every time whatever either party does this, they move the window of what's acceptable. And right. So what you're seeing now is the Republicans are more willing to accept the use of unilateral executive power because Obama did it and because Trump is doing it, if particularly if he does it on such a massive scale as the wall. clearly it is a green light for the folks who are thinking of, well, all right, you know, let's declare a next time there's a school shooting, let's declare a national emergency. Clearly, you know, there could be a hurricane, declare a green emergency. This is not, I don't think that this is outside the realm of possibility. And it's one of the reasons why I think up until relatively recently, conservative constitutionalists understood the importance of those guidelines, because, you know, yes, it means that you're not going to hashtag win as much, but the left is always going to be more creative and less and feeling less constrained to do what it wants than the constitutional right. So if the right gives up that sense of, okay, you're not going to win because we need to follow these procedures, then we are in a brave new world.
Yeah, I would think of this, if the president does use emergency power here, I would think of it as his version of DACA, you know, the non-enforcement of immigration laws for a wide part of the population. The fact is that prosecutorial discretion and presidential enforcement discretion is a longstanding feature of our law. It's always been the exception rather than the rule, really. The basic premise is the presidents and their people should enforce the laws, not unenforce them. And when President Obama took the step of using non-enforcement to radically change the nation's approach to immigration, he really, to use a Milwaukee metaphor, jumped the shark. Yeah. He really took this exceptional doctrine past the breaking point. And I will say, I think the Obama administration, as they constructed legal arguments saying, well, there's nothing new here. This is just enforcement discretion. We have scarce resources. This is just another example of a totally mundane administrative issue of non-enforcement. I think everybody in the public, in the courts, and even in the administration themselves knew that that wasn't really true. Same thing here. When the President Trump, if he ultimately uses an emergency declaration to move the wall, they'll make all sorts of arguments that this is just, you know, mundane use of one of many declaration statutes and emergency declarations. They'll say this is just nothing new. This is very mundane, when everybody knows that, in fact, it's quite different. And I just to add to that, though, this is a way in which administrations in recent years have tended to overstep and have gotten pushback from the courts. We saw this again in the Obama administration, whether it was DACA, which began to come under serious legal fire, but was never fully litigated because the administration ended before the cases could be finished. But even with some of the later climate change regulations and the Waters of the United States rule, where the administration really pushed things, took old longstanding statutes and pushed them past the breaking point, you saw the courts push back because the judges recognized that the circumstances, both the facts of the policy, but also the broader circumstances of the state of government, were not quite what the government was saying in defense of their case. That in fact, what they were doing was much more radical than they suggested. Same thing with the Bush administration. I think this is a key thing to learn about the Bush administration. At the onset of the global war on terror, the Bush administration had to figure out what to do with terrorist detainees. They said, let's bring them to Guantanamo Bay in Cuba, where they're outside of U.S. jurisdiction, and we can do this in light of longstanding Supreme Court precedents that leave a lot of room for the president to maintain control of prisoners, especially when they are outside of the territorial jurisdiction of the United States. And it's true, if you took those old 1940s precedents literally and didn't think seriously that the global war on terror was actually something profoundly different from all the wars that came before, then the Bush administration would have been fine. But the Bush administration found over and over again that the courts saw those old precedents differently in the light of current circumstances. The Obama administration had the same problem with things like DACA and some of its later, more radical greenhouse gas regulations. And I think the Trump administration, likewise, if they take for granted that the old precedents apply and the old statutes should be read the same in the current circumstances as under the old circumstances, they're really going to miss the most important thing that the Supreme Court will see, which is namely this completely different political environment, governance environment, and the ramifications of what could follow. I think the courts will, I think the Supreme Court will see this much differently than the administration does.
Very, very interesting. And of course, going back to a comment you made before, people are probably wondering, why is the phrase "jump the shark" a Milwaukee reference?
Right.
Of course, it's from Happy Days. I assume that at least some of our really, you know, pop culture listeners understand that when Fonzie actually jumps the shark, literally, and that's where it comes from. So people need to understand that Happy Days, which was, you know, based in Milwaukee, was the source of that phrase. Which has that phrase jumped at the shark? Have we gotten to the point where that one has gotten?
Yeah. Jumping the shark is the new shark. We've got to find something else to jump it.
Yeah, that's the problem. There's an expiration date on all of these expressions. Adam White, thank you so much for joining me today. This was absolutely fascinating, and I think we are about to find out. We're about to enter into some very strange, uncharted territory. And I appreciate it very much that you joined us.
Thanks, Charlie.
And thank you for listening to the Daily Bulwark podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again.